Iran's president says Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and considers useful talks which result in the removal of all oppressive sanctions. Moscow says a new military pact between Australia, Britain, and the U.S. is a hostile step aimed not only at China, but also at Russia. And U.S. Democratic lawmakers remove military funding for Israel from legislation to fund the government after objections from progressive lawmakers. Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in at World News. World leaders have come together in the 76th United Nations General Assembly session to discuss global issues and crises. Fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal has also been discussed by both Iranian and American presidents. Iran's message has been one of multilateralism and rejecting inhumane sanctions.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. president, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5+1 to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people. And two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appear to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
Political commentator Mark Weber believes that Washington's anti-Tehran sanctions constitute a breach of international law.
Well, the remarks by the Iranian president are quite right. The sanctions policy of the Biden administration, which is continuing the sanctions policy of the Trump administration, is a form of economic warfare. It's contrary not only to international law, but also to the principle of global cooperation that President Biden says he wants to uphold and claims to respect. But the actual record is very different. You know, the sanctions policy is contrary to the, of course, 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which represents a world consensus. But this deal is not one that the United States really has, under international law, the right to disobey. It's a United Nations Security Council resolution. All member states of the United Nations are obliged to uphold and follow United Nations Security Council resolutions. So when the Biden administration talks on the one side of its mouth about international cooperation and the rule of law, and on the other hand continues the sanctions against Iran, it is speaking hypocritically. It's not showing by actions that it really means what it says in words. And that's a very bad thing.
Moscow says a new trilateral military pact between Britain, Australia, and the U.S. is a hostile step aimed at not only China, but also Russia. Secretary of the Russian Security Council denounced the deal, dubbed AUKUS, as yet another military bloc aimed at confronting the two non-Western powers. Nikolai Patrushev said accord will see the U.S. and U.K. team up with Australia to station nuclear submarines deep down in the Pacific Ocean, posing a threat to the entire security architecture of Asia. New partnership has also infuriated France as it saw Australia scrap a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with Paris. France has also slammed the pact as a stab in the back and recalled its ambassadors to Canberra and Washington. Now, U.S. Democratic lawmakers have removed $1 billion in military aid for Israel from a draft version of legislation to fund the American government. Funding for Israel's Iron Dome missile system was in a provision originally included in a bill to keep the federal government funding, but the provision was deleted from a subsequent version after a progressive lawmaker said they opposed the measure if it was included. Lawmakers objected to the provision, citing Palestinian casualties during the most recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip in May. U.S. House is debating a piece of legislation to fund the federal government through December the 3rd and raise the nation's borrowing limit to avert a possible government shutdown. U.S. President Joe Biden comes under bipartisan criticism over the handling of migrants, mainly Haitian nationals, in a border camp in Del Rio, Texas. Republican politicians have criticized lax security, saying the camp hosting some 10,000 migrants is a result of Democrats' push to ease migration restrictions. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer slammed expulsion of migrants to Haiti and expressed anger over border guards' mistreatment of refugees. Several hundred migrants have been sent to Haiti from the Del Rio camp since the weekend, while thousands have been moved into U.S. detention centers for processing. U.N. agencies have also voiced concerns about the deportations of migrants to Haiti, which is still reeling from a presidential assassination and a major earthquake. The European Commission says major differences with Britain relating to elements of Brexit must be settled before the end of December. EU affairs ministers have been discussing growing divisions between Western allies during a meeting in Brussels. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes has sent this report from the Belgian capital.
As government ministers from the 27-nation EU arrived for a meeting at the European Council building in Brussels on Tuesday, it became apparent very quickly that the bloc is lurching towards a bitter showdown with some of its closest allies.
We see when we look at the Brexit agreements that they are not well implemented, that they are not fully respected. We see it with the AUKUS that there was some hidden things, so it's not the best context to have trust between us.
Senior European Commission officials told the EU affairs ministers that Brexit issues relating to Northern Ireland must be sorted out before January 1st. The Commission accuses Britain of breaking its end of the deal.
We need to rebuild the trust. We are ready to do that. We are working very intensely within the Commission. We want to arrive together with our UK partners in the joint solutions.
Outside the meeting, members of workers' unions gathered to warn of further problems for the EU unless poverty and exclusion are addressed.
People are starting to lose hope a bit in the EU project, and I think the Brexit was clearly a sign of that. And I think the recipe to change this is to have a more social Europe.
EU affairs ministers agreed to seek further information on the move by the US, Britain and Australia to scupper a multi-billion euro submarine deal that Paris had with Canberra.
We definitely remain committed to cooperation with our partners on the international stage, but any new alliances that may appear, of course, raise a number of questions.
The controversy surrounding the new US, UK and Australia weapons agreement, known as AUKUS, has been raised with Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister.
I inquired about the reasons behind the lack of prior consultation on AUKUS and regretted that this alliance excluded European partners
Officials tell me Borrell did not get a straight answer as to why France and the EU were blindsided. It's clear, however, Canberra was lobbied by Washington and London. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. Jerome Hughes at the EU Affairs Ministers meeting, Brussels.
And now back to one of our top stories, where U.S. Democratic lawmakers have removed $1 billion in military aid for Israel from a draft version that is of legislation to fund the American government. Funding for Israel's Iron Dome missile system was in a provision originally included in a bill to keep the federal government funding. And for more on the story, we're going to swing over to Wyatt Reed from Washington, D.C. I guess progressives have a lot to do with the ultimatum they're giving lawmakers with respect to the funding. What's it all about, Wyatt?
Huge humiliation for Israel. In terms of the United States Congress, they pretty much get a blank check in general. They more or less kind of ask and ye shall receive type relationship. So this is very significant. The fact that lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Mark Pocan, were reportedly able to negotiate with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and to eliminate this $1 billion in funding for the Iron Dome. That is funding that every year, as part of an agreement signed under President Obama, Washington hands over, really no strings attached, so that the Israeli regime can defend its citizens whenever it attacks Palestinians from errant rockets. Now, obviously, this is a big deal in that sense, right? That somebody would stand up and just tell Israel, look, you don't get something that you want. Obviously, this is incredibly significant. But I will say that it seems increasingly likely that this $1 billion in funding, rather than not going to Israel at all, will simply be included in the National Defense Authorization Act that comes before Congress in December. So while I think many progressives are extremely heartened to see Representative AOC and others, the so-called squad, progressives quite happy to see them sort of flex this power and achieve something, I think that we're talking about a situation in which this is really a party line sort of vote on this funding measure. So in this particular instance, AOC, a handful of other progressive Democrats really were the line between that funding measure getting passed or it not getting passed at all. And so in that instance, they were able to leverage that influence and to stop this funding. But when it comes to the National Defense Authorization Act, that's more or less a bipartisan bill. A handful of votes wouldn't throw it. So while I think this speaks volumes about the direction that especially younger generations in America are heading, I don't think it's necessarily quite as significant as some observers would say.
All right, bud, stay safe, man. Always a pleasure to get your updates from you from Washington, D.C. Wyatt Reed there joining us. And now Yemenis across the country have marked the 7th anniversary of a revolution they say ended U.S. hegemony in their country. Tens of thousands rallied in the capital Sana'a, as well as the northern city of Sada'a and the western port city of Hodeidah to commemorate a revolution which took place on September 21, 2014. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to commemorate the revolution that took place on September 21, 2014. Following that revolution, the government of the former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi collapsed.
The 21st September revolution means freedom and independence for us, which prompted 17 countries led by Saudi Arabia to launch a war on Yemen on 26 March 2015. This revolution is a resistance against the Israeli project in the region and a resistance against Saudi Arabia's miscalculations, which is prevalent in our country. So today we are paying the price for our freedom.
Our protest is in response to the call of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, and it is a commemoration of the anniversary of the 21st September revolution, during which Yemenis gained freedom, independence, and sovereignty of their country.
Protesters said the revolution was triggered by the Yemenis themselves without any foreign intervention as a result of the deterioration of living conditions under the rule of the former president.
This large demonstration is evidence of the growing awareness among the Yemenis of the need to get out of the state of exclusion that prevailed under the rule of the former regime. The 21st September revolution saved Yemenis from external domination, and Yemenis today own their decision. The battles that are taking place today between Yemeni army and the Saudi-backed forces are the result of the Yemenis' exit from Saudi control.
We came out today to announce to the world that the September 21st revolution is the revolution of all free Yemenis, and to affirm our rejection of foreign domination and our boycott of proxies and traitors, whether in Yemen or the rest of the Arab countries.
Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi was backed by Saudi Arabia that even waged an ongoing war to reinstate him. The Saudi-led war on the country has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others since 2015.
Yemenis say their revolution was aimed at preserving the sovereignty of their country, which was under the control of the U.S. and Saudi proxies. They believe that the Saudi brutal war on their country is the price for the freedom they have gained. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Authorities on the Spanish Canary island of La Palma are evacuating more people as lava from an erupting volcano is nearing residential areas. New fissures emerged in the Cumbre Vieja volcano, prompting authorities there to evacuate some 500 more people. The volcano has so far forced a total of 6,000 people from their homes. It's also destroyed a large number of properties and land, spanning a huge area since it erupted on Sunday. Last eruption on La Palma was in 1971, when another part of the same volcanic range erupted on the southern side of the island. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all around the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to touch and talk about some, let's say, questions or misunderstandings which are being asked by different questioners about the theological issues and any question regarding the religious concepts. For this, we invite Islamic researchers and scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. The first question that we are going to talk about is about the different levels, or let's say floors, of hell. This is what we are going to talk about, and that's why we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to join us in this studio and help us with answer. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Sheikh, the first question, as I mentioned earlier, is about the different levels and floors in hell, in the hell, or Jahannam. How many floors does it have, and who belongs to these floors? That is there any, let's say, cue or any narration that tells us, for example, these group of people enter that floor, or the other groups enter the other floor or the other level? So I wanted to see if it's a series of levels or floors there that people are going to be classified and, let's say, categorized in these levels, and any person based on the actions and whatever he or she did in this world is going to enter any of these floors. This is a question that we need you to help us with the answer.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that when it comes to the righteous people, not all of them are in the same level. So divine justice requires that there should be different levels in paradise, and each person based on his or her good actions would be in one of the levels. The same is true about the hellfire. I mean, those people who are going to go to the hell, they are not in the same level based on their bad deeds.
The same goes for the paradise, right?
Yeah. The justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala requires that the punishment for the people who are going to go to the hellfire cannot be the same. People are different based on their actions, and there need to be different levels. For the paradise, we have the term darj, and the plural form is darajat, levels. Mm-hmm. And for the hellfire, we have the concept of dark, which is mentioned in the Quran, and the plural form is darakat. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in chapter An-Nisa, verse 145, إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ فِي الدَّرْكِ الْأَسْفَلِ مِنَ النَّارِ. The hypocrites, they are in the lowest level, which is the most difficult one. Now, before answering the question, we need to know that not all the details about the Day of Judgment are mentioned in the Quran and in the narrations too. So for sure, we need to, as Muslims, we need to believe in the hereafter, in the Day of Judgment. This is a fundamental belief. But should we know about all the details? Not necessarily. I mean, a person can be a Muslim without knowing the answer of today's question. How many levels do we have in the hellfire? Some of the details, the intellect has nothing to say regarding these issues. I mean, when you ask your intellect how many levels are there in the hellfire, the intellect might say that there must be different levels because the actions are different, but how many, the intellect does not have any answer. So we need to refer to the verses of the Quran and the narrations.
Exactly.
Now, when it comes to the Noble Book of Quran, we have only one verse talking about seven gates for the hellfire. In chapter Al-Hijr, verse 44, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَإِنَّ جَهَنَّمَ لَمَوْعِدُكُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ لَهَا سَبْعَةُ أَبْوَابٍ. The hellfire has seven gates. لِكُلِّ بَابٍ مِّنْهُمْ جُزْءٌ مَقْسُومٌ. And to each gate belongs a separate portion of them.
Mm-hmm.
So for sure, we have seven gates for the hellfire.
Seven main gates, let's say. Seven main gates.
No.
Because any of them, again, has some other gates inside, right?
The verse is silent about that. The verse says that for each gate there are, a group which will enter from a special gate. Whether we have each gate has some other gates inside, the verse doesn't refer to that. It might be mentioned in the narrations. Now, so the Holy Book of Quran does not talk about different floors, so to speak. It's only talking about seven gates. But some narrations tell us that these seven gates are, in practice, seven floors and seven levels. For example, in one narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam mentions that these are called Jahim, Lazza, Saqar, Hutama, Hawiya, Sa'ir, Jahannam, inshallah I will explain. And some narrations tell us that, according to some narration, one day Jibreel descended to the Prophet, and the Prophet asked the Archangel Jibreel that are the doors of hellfire like the doors of our houses? Jibreel said that no, the doors of the hellfire, all of them are open, and some of them are below the other ones, which means that they are somehow different floors. It's not only door. It's also different levels and floors. And the narration also talks about the distance between two doors, for example. It says that it takes about 70 years for one person to go from one door to another door.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And in this narration, the Holy Prophet asks about those people who are in each and every floor each and every gate. And Jibril explains that, for example, in the first one, which is the lowest one, the hypocrites are there. And the second one, the mushrikeen, the polytheists, and the rest of the narration. Now, in one specific narration, we have the names of all these seven floors and each group which inhabit in that floor.
True.
The first one, which is the lowest one, according to this narration, is called Jahannam. And this narration is based on the verses of the Noble Book of Quran. Jahannam is the lowest one, and the hypocrites are there. As I mentioned in chapter An-Nisa, verse 145, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ فِي الدَّرْكِ الْأَسْفَلِ مِنَ النَّارِ. Indeed, the hypocrites are in the lowest reach or level of the fire. وَلَنْ تَجِدَ لَهُمْ نَصِيرًا. And you will not find any helper for them. So this is the first one. The second one, according to this narration, is called Lazza. This is based on verse 14 of chapter Al-Layl. فَأَنذَرْتُكُمْ نَارًا تَلَظَّى. So I warned you of a blazing fire. So the word Lazza is taken from this verse. لَا يَصْلَاهَا إِلَّا الْأَشْقَى. Which none shall enter except the most wretched. And the narration talks about some of the details and features of this place. What are the punishments which are specific to this level? The third level is called Hutama. And this is based on chapter Humaza, which read, woe to every scandal monger and slanderer who amasses wealth and counts it over. He supposes his wealth will make him immortal. No, indeed, he will surely be cast into the crusher, Hutama. وَمَا أَدْرَاكَ مَا الْحُتَمَةَ. And what will show you what is the crusher? It is the fire of Allah set ablaze, which will overspread the heart. So this is the third one. The fourth one, according to this narration, is called Saqar. This is based on verse 26 of chapter Al-Muddathir. سَأُسْلِيهِ Saqar. I will cast him into the Saqar. وَمَا أَدْرَاكَ مَا Saqar. And the narration says that, for example, there is, the fire in this level is so hot that it doesn't, it removes the whole skin of the body, and 12 angels are the guardians of this level, and the rest of the narration. The fifth one is called Jahim. This is based on verse 37 of chapter An-Nazi'at. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فأما من تقى وآثر الحياة الدنيا. So the verse talks about those people who are in this level. As for him who was rebellious and preferred the life of this world, فَإِنَّ الْجَحِيمَ هِيَ الْمَأْوَى. So his refuge will be Jahim. And then we have the sixth level, which is called Sa'ir. This is based on the verse 12 of chapter Saba. Which reads, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَمَنْ يَزِغْ مِنْهُمْ عَنْ أَمْرِنَا نُذِقْهُ مِنْ عَذَابِ السَّعِيرِ. Whoever turned aside from our commandment, our command from among them, we made him taste the punishment of Sa'ir, which literally means burning. And the last one is called Hawiyah. This is based on chapter Qara'a, verse 9, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَأَمَّا مَنْ خَفَّتْ مَوَازِينُهُ But as for him whose deeds weigh light in the scale, فَأُمُّهُ هَاوِيَ His home will be هَاوِيَ So this is one important narration in which the names of different levels are mentioned.
Okay, thank you very much, dear Sheikh. So we have heard of seven different stages and levels of Jahannam or the hell. And those who are going to enter, it has been said that there are seven important gates in seven gates in Jahannam that different categories of people enter. Those who were arrogant, those who were hypocrites, and whatever Sheikh Murtada Karim explained and actually elaborated on. Let's take refuge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to include and put us among the people of the paradise and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us for whatever bad or whatever sin we have committed and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with the love of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam to save us from these dangerous and wretched stages and levels of Jahannam. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and enlightenment, and your respected listeners for your staying tuned and listening to Canaan Islamic Beliefs. I hope you enjoyed the show and will join us again in our upcoming session where we shall discuss some other doubts and misconceptions there. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شنيحا
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's message, which he had issued to the seminaries and ulema in the last month of his life. We discussed the Imam's views on the struggles of ulema and their sacrifices in the way of God, to awaken people and to confront oppression on the one hand and sanctimony on the other. The Imam has pointed out that the true ulema have always been supportive of the downtrodden and the oppressed strata against tyrannical and puppet rulers. We also discussed Imam Khomeini's warning in his testimony to the seminaries and great ulema against deviation. Stay tuned to follow the discussion. One of the important axes that have been stressed in Imam Khomeini's testimony is the necessity of new organization in the structure of seminaries. The Imam, as a pioneer in this field, believed that if the seminaries did not embark on reform and development under the supervision of the sources of emulation and great ulema, others would step in for the purpose with wicked goals. This had been experienced during the rule of illiterate and ruthless Reza Khan, whose real aim was to obliterate ulema and Islam in Iran. Therefore, during the era of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini strove to reform the seminaries, especially that of Qom. But he faced obstructionism of opportunities and dogmatic elements who had infiltrated the ranks of clergymen under the guise of benevolent persons. Imam Khomeini was very concerned about reformation of the structure of seminaries, even when he was in exile. Imam Khomeini's warnings during the tough times in Najaf would arouse committed ulema and young students to reform the seminaries. He made all these efforts alongside his struggles for the Islamic Revolution. He told the students and ulema, "You will be able to remove these corruptions and difficulties and thwart their colonial schemes only through self-expurgation, preparation and proper order. If you do not reform yourselves, do not become equipped and do not make order and discipline rule over your lessons and life, you will be, God forbid, doomed to destruction in the future. Before losing the opportunity and before the enemy gains access to all your religious and scientific affairs, ponder, wake up and rise up. In the first phase, embark on self-expurgation, purification, and reformation. Become equipped and orderly. Set up order and discipline in seminaries. Do not let others come and make seminaries orderly. Do not let the enemies administer the seminaries with the pretext that these people are not qualified. They cannot do anything and they are a handful of jobless people who have gathered together in seminaries so that they would corrupt the seminaries in the name of order and reform, and would subjugate you. Do not give them pretext. If you become orderly and self-expurgated, and all your affairs are orderly, others would not have view upon you, and would not find way to infiltrate the seminaries and the community of clergymen. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution and foundation of the Islamic Republic in Iran, naturally the necessity of new organization in seminaries was highlighted more than ever. As the grounds were set for this purpose, Imam Khomeini was more sensitive on the issue. He writes in his testimony, "I recommend for all eras, especially the current era, as the schemes and plots have become faster and stronger, that the uprising for organization of seminaries is necessary and essential, so that the ulema and great figures would spend time and, through accurate program, preserve seminaries, especially the Qom Seminary, and other great and important seminaries against ills in this juncture in time." Another serious concern of Imam Khomeini with regards to the ulema and seminaries was his high emphasis on safeguarding the traditional jurisprudence known as Fiqh-e Jawahiri or Jawahiri jurisprudence. He writes in his historical message, "As for education and research in seminaries, I believe in the traditional jurisprudence and Jawahiri ijtihad and do not consider as permissible to disregard it. Ijtihad, independent reasoning on the basis of the Quran and Hadith, is correct on the same basis, but it does not mean that the jurisprudence of Islam is not dynamic. Time and place are two determining elements in ijtihad. What used to have an edict in the past, it seems that the same issue may get a new edict in terms of the relations ruling on politics, society, and economy of system. A jurisprudent should smartly and sharply guide a great Islamic and even non-Islamic society, and beside sincerity, God-wariness, and asceticism, which are worth a jurisprudent, should be really a prudent manager." Imam Khomeini points to this issue in his testimony too. "It is necessary that the respectable ulema and teachers not allow lessons that are related to jurisprudence and the jurisprudential seminaries of the grand ulema, which are the only way for preservation of the Islamic jurisprudence, to become deviated and try to increase precision, debate, discussion, and research every day. The traditional jurisprudence, which is the heritage of the righteous predecessors and deviation from it, will weaken the pillars of research and erudition, must be preserved, and researches should be increased. Of course, programs will be prepared in other sciences concerning the needs of the country, and Islam and people should be trained in those fields." Dear listeners, next time, we will continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United Kingdom, the gas price increase has led to record electricity market prices too, because the United Kingdom relies on gas-fired power plants to generate almost half of its electricity. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by James Tapper, Gillian Ambrose, and Michael Savage. The piece is titled Don't Panic. Business Minister Vista supposedly calmed crisis fears as UK gas prices soar. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. The British government was scrambling on Saturday night, 18th of September, to reassure Britons that rising gas prices would not plunge the country into an energy crisis, as ministers held a series of emergency meetings with energy companies and regulators to establish whether the nation could keep the lights and central heating on this winter. A senior industry insider likened the meetings held between the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, and energy industry leaders to the early crisis talks held following the outbreak of COVID-19. Gas prices surged by more than 70% in August alone, and the shock has sent energy companies and heavy industrial firms out of business. According to some estimates, households could see energy bills jump by as much as £400 in a year. A lack of carbon dioxide, a byproduct of heavy industry, means food shortages will become more acute. After 8 hours of one-on-one discussions, Energy Minister Kwasi Kwarteng announced further talks with regulator Ofgem, and in coming days will meet industry leaders again to thrash out ways to keep the industry afloat and prevent millions falling into fuel poverty. Surging prices of natural gas have pushed 7 energy suppliers out of business this year, and the BBC reported on Saturday night that 4 more may go next week. Energy Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng is also working with other ministers to avert other knock-on effects of the gas crisis. The food industry is already grappling with a shortage of carbon dioxide after gas price increases forced 2 fertilizer plants to shut down. The owner of Bernard Matthews has said the shortage of carbon dioxide means Christmas will be cancelled. In a recent statement, the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, went to some lengths to try to reassure the public, saying there was no cause for immediate concern. He claimed, "I was reassured that security of supply was not a cause for immediate concern within the industry." He added, The UK benefits from having a diverse range of gas supply sources with sufficient capacity to more than meet demand. The UK's gas system continues to operate reliably, and we do not expect supply emergencies this winter. The business secretary, Kwarteng, said protecting customers and energy security were both an absolute priority, and Ofgem would ensure that customers of firms that went bust would continue to receive gas and electricity. He claimed, "We are confident supply can be maintained. Our largest single source of gas is from domestic production, and the vast majority of imports come from reliable suppliers such as Norway. We're not dependent on Russian oil and gas." He said ministers from across government would be drawn in to manage the wider implications of the global gas price increase. A senior industry insider said the business secretary aimed to hold up to 20 one-on-one meetings with energy industry leaders in the coming days as an intelligence gathering exercise to bottom out how bad things might be. The government is understood to be open to considering short-term measures to help companies and households weather the looming winter energy crisis, but could also consider a long-term shake-up to accelerate the UK's shift away from fossil fuels and address the fragility in the energy retail market. The source said, "There's nothing about this situation that wouldn't be better if we were less reliant on gas." Gas prices have surged globally following a long winter in which gas stores across Europe and Asia were heavily depleted. Storage levels remain well below average, and gas imports into Europe from Norway, Russia, and West Asia have slowed. In Britain, the gas price increase has led to record electricity market prices too, because the UK relies on gas-fired power plants to generate almost half of its electricity. Low wind speeds have reduced the UK's renewable energy generation, and a string of problems at UK power plants and a major cable connecting the UK to France have forced market prices higher. The rocketing price of gas has also caused a Europe-wide slowdown for some chemical factories that produce fertilizers, a byproduct of which is carbon dioxide, used food industry, as well as in the meat industry to stun animals before slaughter. Fertilizer plants in Teesside and Cheshire have already shut down. Ranjit Singh Boparan, the owner of Bernard Matthews and Two Sisters Food Group, said the supply of turkey at Christmas could not be guaranteed, adding, "The carbon dioxide issue is a massive body blow and puts us at breaking point, it really does. That's poultry, beef, pork, as well as the wider food industry." Dermot Nolan, a former chief executive of Ofgem, said the increases were the result of depleted stocks following a cold winter last year, reduced supply from Russia, and increased demand for liquefied natural gas from the Far East. He told the BBC Radio 4 Today programme, "It is not obvious to me what can be done in the very short run. Britain does have secure, relatively diverse sources of gas, so I think the lights will stay on." He added, "But I'm afraid it is likely, in my view, that the high gas and high electricity prices will be sustained for the next 3 to 4 months." According to the Energy Shop Price Comparison website, Ofgem has already increased the price cap from an average of £1,138 per year to £1,277 for the next month for someone on a standard variable tariff. The next official review is in April, when it may rise above £1,500. Ed Miliband, Labour's shadow business secretary, said the gas price increases were part of a cost of living crisis that underlined the need to cancel the government's planned £20 a week cut to universal credit. Ed Miliband added, "It is a fundamental failure of long-term government planning over the last decade that we are so exposed and vulnerable as a country, and it is business and consumers that are paying the price. He added, if we had been investing at sufficient scale in diverse, secure, zero-carbon energy supplies and making energy efficiency a much bigger priority, we would not be in such a precarious position today. Darren Jones, chair of the House of Commons Business Select Committee, said, "We've known for some time that the United Kingdom is over-reliant on imported gas. Customers on low incomes need targeted help this autumn and winter, and ministers need to get a move on building a more resilient and sustainable UK energy system. With about 80% of Britain's 27.8 million households connected to gas main supply, the UK relies heavily on natural gas." According to OGUK's Will Webster, nearly half comes from North Sea fields, with much of the rest supplied via pipelines from Norway. But the North Sea output will halve by 2027. He said, "Letting production fall faster that we can reduce demand risk leaves us increasingly dependent on other countries and at the mercy of global events over which we have no control. Countries such as Germany rely much more on gas from Russia, and the nearly completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea has been a source of concern for NATO countries worried that it will give Russian President Vladimir Putin political leverage in Europe." Gazprom, Russia's state-owned energy company, was accused by 42 members of the European Parliament from across the political spectrum of alleged deliberate market manipulation recently, as they called for the European Commission to investigate. Energy UK, which represents energy suppliers in Britain, claimed firms will give people extra support this winter. Ofgem said the record prices were undoubtedly putting pressure on companies, and it had processes in place to purportedly help customers and companies that failed.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.